The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I think we should...
Hello.
Hi, Rob Paul.
I think we should get started. We're already about 15 minutes behind, and we have a lot of things to discuss. So I'm going to actually keep my remarks much briefer than I'd planned, and... if you don't mind, in these packets, there's bios of everybody, so I'm going to do no introductions in the interest of time so that we can hear substance instead of
fluff.
You know, as we've been discussing, peace and justice are both indispensable ingredients for us to be able to live in a free and just world. Yet, it's a very real tension between peace and justice, particularly during negotiations aimed at ending an armed conflict. In the midst of war, when life itself is quite literally a living hell, and death and atrocities are everyday occurrences, there is an understandable tendency to say that anything, including giving up rights to justice, are appropriate if the warring factions agree to end the conflict. This panel will grapple with many of these issues. Many already highlighted this afternoon. Is it appropriate to prioritize peace over justice or vice versa? Can negotiators legally or morally agree to grant amnesty to perpetrators of crimes against humanity or genocide? Can peace be truly enduring if the perpetrators are allowed to get away scot-free? Is it appropriate to take amnesty off the table if it might end a conflict years before it would otherwise end? This panel will discuss several of these issues. We're going to focus not exclusively, but largely on Uganda. So I now turn the microphone over to Robert Pulver.
Hi, I'm Robert Pulver, and I'm working with the United Nations Department of Peacekeeping Operations on rule of law issues. And I'd just like to throw out a few issues or principles that probably run the gamut from very simplistic to hopefully a little bit provocative. And I think if we're looking at the impact of international criminal justice mechanisms on peace initiatives, we could also flip the coin a little bit and look at the impact of peace initiatives on justice. So the first principle that I'd like to throw out really, and it's already been implied, I think, by many speakers in some of the other sessions, that you really can't have fully effective prosecutions or true accountability in most of the conflict situations that we're engaged in the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, at least, if you don't have some semblance of peace first. Without a semblance of peace, of course, it's difficult or impossible to gather evidence. The last panel on apprehensions, of course, apprehensions would be very, very difficult in a continuing war situation. And, of course, even if you do get through and have a conviction in a still warlike situation, I think that's going to be maybe justice done, but not justice that seemed to be done. It can be something outside of the country that is not even connected with the people of the country, with victims, with local communities, and there's always in an ongoing conflict the likelihood that such justice, there would be a claim that the prosecution is politically motivated or even a tool of the conflict, and you all recall some of the arguments that Milosevic was making during his trial in that regard. The second principle that I'd like to throw out, and as certainly was implied by the Chief Prosecutor Ocampo at lunch, is that a prosecution can, in fact, undermine a peace process. And I think we'll hear more on that discussion and debate as we talk other panelists about Uganda. But I would also think about Sudan. The strategy for the North-South peace process in Sudan very clearly on the political level said, let's not tangle up Darfur in that. And the strategy was that, and the thinking was that, if we were to tangle up the whole Darfur conflict in the North-South negotiations, it would all fall apart. Many will have views on whether that was the right judgment, the wrong judgment, whether focus on Darfur should have come earlier but separated from the North-South peace agreement, etc. The third principle that I would throw out is that, the other side of that coin, is that prosecutions can have a stabilizing effect on peace and security in a given country. We had one of the commentators this morning from the floor who pointed out, I think it was the UNMIC in Kosovo, characterization of some speech as vigilante speech. And what I recall the person saying today was that if there had been a quicker move by the United Nations and by the international community to have some accountability in Kosovo, then there would have been less of the need for people to sort of pursue their own justice initiatives, vigilantism, etc. And of course, to see justice being done through a fair and impartial process can have a tremendous calming effect and reassuring effect on a population that's very important for peace and security. So I think reconciling this so-called dichotomy between peace and justice can be very difficult. But let me just throw out a quote from the Secretary General's August 2004 report on the rule of law and transitional justice in conflict and post-conflict societies. And I quote, "Justice and peace are not contradictory forces. Rather, properly pursued, they promote and sustain one another. The question then can never be whether to pursue justice and accountability, but rather when and how." And this really implies to me a fourth principle, probably a simple one, but probably also ignored. As we heard at lunch, there is a need and a strong need for justice practitioners to be in close consultation with political actors, diplomats, academicians, to consult broadly. I think if this occurs, when this occurs, political actors, when shaping peace agreements, will be much more aware of the imperatives and issues surrounding justice. And justice sector actors and so-called practitioners will be more aware of the political and security and social implications of prosecutorial decisions. Now, I'm not saying that those decisions should be less independent or politicized, et cetera, but that it should take place with a full knowledge, full multidisciplinary knowledge of the issues. Then the fifth principle, as mentioned by Professor Ornblicher, and I think I should call her Diane because she's probably the most referred to in this conference so far, but the importance of consultation with victims and local communities. Now, she said that this should not just be sort of a one-way sharing of information. And I would go perhaps even a step further and say nationals should be engaged in helping to choose the justice mechanisms and approaches that are going to apply. You know, we look at discussions right now on Burundi, ideas about a special chamber there, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Should it just be the internationals making their learned decision about what should go on there in terms of international mechanisms? Or should we really find a way to fully engage civil society in Burundi? And again, from the Secretary General's Rule of Law and Transitional Justice Report, I quote, "Ultimately, no rule of law reform, justice reconstruction, or transitional justice initiative imposed from the outside can have a hope to be successful or sustainable. We must support," and he speaks as the United Nations, "we must support and facilitate national consultations aimed at determining the national course for transitional justice." And I think this perceived tension that Kelly referred to between prosecutions and peace suggests also the need for more holistic approaches. We're not just probably talking about international tribunals and peace agreement and political approaches. So I think a sixth principle I would throw out there is the need to focus more holistically on other transitional justice approaches and mechanisms, as well as strengthening national rule of law institutions, truth-seeking, reconciliation, reparations, vetting, and all sorts of efforts to build the national institutions of justice going forward. And in this regard, I would just point out the budget for the two ad hoc tribunals, as you all know, is extraordinary. Somewhere in the nature of $250 million per annum, which is about 15% of the UN's regular budget. I'm not saying that's too much, but I'm saying we need to make a similar commitment and effort to strengthening national rule of law institutions, and that this is a vital effort. And right now, I think we're spending only a fraction of that amount on that initiative. And so let me close with a final principle, and again, a quote from the SG's report. Our main goal is not to build international substitutes for national structures, but to help build domestic justice capacities.
Okay. Someone help me out. First of all, I'd really like to thank American University for having us here today. It's a real privilege to be able to speak here. And secondly, this will be a joint presentation with my colleague, Eric. What I intend to do is reverse a little bit, and instead of talking about the International Criminal Court, talk a little bit about the situation in Uganda itself, and then we will speak about our research and come up with a couple of conclusions. I'm not a Uganda expert, so this comes to you very much just as the impressions of someone who's been able to go there a couple of times. But in essence, in order to frame this entire debate, I think there are four important points that I would like to point to. First is the extent of the humanitarian crisis on the ground in northern Uganda. Second is what the government has done in response to that. And then the third flows from that, because I think locally some of the government initiatives are perceived as inadequate, and therefore there are also a number of local initiatives to complement that. And then fourthly, those will help to frame a little bit the discussion that's taking place around the intervention of the International Criminal Court. So the first of these is simply to say a word or two about the Lord's Resistance Army, which has been plaguing northern Uganda for about 19 years. It's a very small rebel army. There's a lot of controversy about its actual size, but it could be anywhere from the hundreds into the 2,000 or 3,000. It's headed by a self-proclaimed prophet/leader called Joseph Kony, and it's largely comprised of abductees, many of whom are abducted as children. Also important to know, apart from the length of the conflict, which lends it a particular dynamic, is the nature of the atrocities, which tend to be really very terrible, including killings and mutilations of all sorts. But having said that, I'll just show you a few. I'll expose you to my amateur photography for just a second. So, this is a picture of one of the better IDP camps. But in northern Uganda, above 90% of the population live in IDP camps, and in really desperate circumstances. Absolute squalor, high unemployment, and really a very hopeless and desperate situation. These are some of the returnees from the LRA. And although these are quite young, it's not atypical for the returnees to be very young. And most of them pass through reception centers. This is, again, a picture taken in one of the IDP camps where again, one can see how children in particular are affected by this conflict and how they're subjected to, there may be as high as 30% orphanage in the IDP camps. Child mothers or women who return from the LRA after having been in sexual slavery or captivity situations often have a particularly difficult time. Also in regard to the children that they bring out of the bush with them, which are not accepted easily into the local communities. Here, children who return from the LRA, often in the reception centers, draw very explicit violent images, weapons, etc., and crimes being committed after they've been there for a while. Usually the pictures normalize. And then finally, another very prevalent and unique phenomenon in northern Uganda is the fact that children commute nightly into the town centers to sleep because they fear abduction if they sleep too far away from the towns. Now here in this picture, and this is a final picture which introduces us to some of the initiatives which are being taken in response to this huge crisis. And the gentleman with the white flak jacket over on the far side of the picture is actually a senior member of the LRA who's been granted amnesty. And I will return and say something about that. But in essence, the government response is two-track. One is peace negotiations through the senior negotiator, Betty Bigombe. And secondly, simultaneously, they're also pursuing a military solution. And so they're fighting the LRA, and some would argue that in some ways the ICC referral fits within that because it would need military assistance to carry out an arrest. Some of the difficult questions about the government response has been, for instance, that the insurgency in the north is one of a wider pattern of insurgencies in Uganda. There have been about 16. There have also been some questions about the government commitment to the peace process in the way in which the government has conducted itself in giving very tight deadlines to respond, etc. And there are also genuine questions about the effectiveness of the military strategy, considering this has gone on for so long, and considering that we're really talking about a very small group of rebels. The situation in the north, therefore, is one of absolute desperation, I think, to end this conflict. But mixed with that is also an ambivalence, because the crimes are being committed largely by people who have been kidnapped out of the Acholi tribe against Acholi themselves. And the government, in many ways, is the outside actor in this equation. And that leads to a certain ambivalence, and also a lot of dissatisfaction with how the government has handled the crisis. So this has given rise to a number of northern initiatives, and three of these kind of lump together, because I think religious and traditional leaders have recently, in particular in the last 4 to 5 years, I think really consolidated their position and tried to find local solutions for some of this. And so one of the suggestions is, for instance, that the LRA atrocities and reintegration should be dealt with through traditional justice ceremonies, which may include cleansing ceremonies or more elaborate ceremonies. These are currently not, the cleansing ceremonies are fairly widely practiced, but the more elaborate ceremonies have not been widely practiced. And another very interesting initiative is the Amnesty Act of 2000, which, as stated before, was an act that came about through a widespread consultative process and is therefore quite unique, which actually requires very, very little from people who come out of the bush. All they have to do is report to the Amnesty Commission, and then they're given a certificate. And there's a lot of discussion about that process and how should, and the gentleman you saw before is one of the beneficiaries. So the reason for why we first became interested in northern Uganda was because what we saw was a polarization in the debate about what was the best way to deal with this issue. And I would say that after the ICC referral, the debate became more intense about those who argued for pursuing the peace process on the one hand, and those who were more outspoken about justice on the other. And some of the specific objections against the ICC in the Ugandan context have been, one, that the ICC is a spoiler to the peace process, two, that the ICC ignores local justice options, three, that the ICC will somehow exacerbate the situation or lead to an increase in violence or perhaps the targeting of vulnerable groups, and four, that the ICC would somehow be biased. Now, our interest was really out of the third question because we found that, the third question on the screen, we found that this debate was becoming very heated and there were many people, I think, who were keen to say, this is what victims want, that is what victims want within this situation. And that is why we endeavored to carry out this research, which Eric will now present to you.
Thank you, Marika. excuse me, I tend to lose my voice at the end of the day. One thing, I've taken my jacket off because I'm from Berkeley and we don't wear suits an awful lot, so forgive me. And I'm also a non-lawyer here, so. I'm glad that Marika showed some photographs because I think it's important for us not to just discuss these issues in the abstract, but to get an understanding that this really affects real people. And that I can tell you, in my experience, I've spent 28 years working in human rights. And I have led forensic teams in to do exhumations of mass graves in over a dozen countries. I've worked on landmines issues, torture, and so on. When I went to northern Uganda the first time in March, I went in with a Human Rights Watch mission. We spent about a month in 10 camps. There were about 200 of those camps. I was absolutely appalled at what I saw. Over 200 camps, 1.4, 1.6 million people held in those camps because of a government that isn't really going after the LRA like it should be, but also a force that could be no more than maybe 2,000 fighters. And the neglect on the part of the international community to these people in these camps. Having said that, the reason the International Center for Transitional Justice and my center at Berkeley got involved was exactly what Marika was saying, is we had a sense we had this polarized debate. On one side was justice and the other side was peace. And I know in my experience, I happened to be talking to someone at the ICC and they said, well, look, we know that everyone in Uganda supports the ICC. And one antenna went up. And then when I was in northern Uganda in March, someone said to me, well, you know, the Acholi people are forgiving people. They want to forgive. They don't want justice. And in my time working in forensics in countries where massive crimes like this have taken place, I have never met a culture that is simply forgiving. It's far more complex than that. So what we wanted to do was to come in and actually talk to the people themselves and ask them their views about a very complex issue. Our research objectives were four. The first was to measure the overall exposure to violence as a result of war and human rights abuses in northern Uganda in 1987. The second was to try and understand the immediate needs of the residents, not only in the camps, but throughout the towns in the north as well, and to capture opinions and attitudes about specific transitional justice mechanisms, trials, traditional justice, truth commissions, reparations. And lastly, to elucidate views on the relationship between peace and justice in northern Uganda. I just completed actually a 5-year study in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda in which we used many of these same techniques or the same studies, using qualitative and quantitative studies to understand what people in those countries themselves think of the ad hoc tribunals or this whole experiment in international justice. So we used one of those techniques, and that is a quantitative survey in which we were doing random sampling in 4 northern districts. And those districts, as you'll see, are Gulu, Kitgum, Lira, and Soroti. And what is important to note here is Gulu and Kitgum are predominantly Acholi, and in Lira and Soroti, You have the two Nanacholi districts, which are Langi and Ateso. And it was important to also get their viewpoints, because many times what you hear are what the leaders in from the Acholi are saying, as opposed to others who have also been affected by the violence. Our sample size was 2,585 individuals who were interviewed. We had trained 22 to 24 interviewers in each of the sites. So these would be Ateso interviewing Ateso, Acholi interviewing Acholi. And none of those were done by Westerners. They were all done by people in the community who were trained. The questionnaire was in 8 sections, and it lasted about 45 minutes to 1 hour. And the languages we used were the native to each of those districts. Now, one of the things we did is we back-translated, because what you often find is a word like justice can mean many different things. Justice is in the eye of the beholder. And linguistically, what really is meant by justice had to be teased out, or even a word that's even more abstract, which is reconciliation. And so we had to actually bring in a team of linguists at the University of Makerere University to look at how are we defining these words, because it was important to get that straight. As it was a university-based study, we do human subjects committee approval, and that's very important because we're interviewing people about very personal issues. We had informed consent, so everyone we interviewed consented to the interview. Interestingly enough, 2% of people who were approached asked not to be interviewed. That's very low for this sort of survey. Our surveys in other countries, we found a much higher level of people, and it's significant, and I'll come to that in a minute. So these are the camps, these are the districts, these are the areas we went into. As I said, this is random sampling, which means we go into a town, we find every 5th street, we go down to the 5th house, and then find somebody to interview, separated from the rest of the members of the family, or in a village or in a camp, we would do the same thing. The sample size here, again, is 2,585, so you see we did 50% male, female. Our median age is around 33, and this is really significant here. This is a population of displacement up to 89-90% in some of these areas. So the exposure to violence, and just a caveat before I discuss briefly some of this. First of all, is when you interview people and you start asking them questions in which they talk about personal violence or what's affected them personally, they tend to sometimes exaggerate. We call it social desirability. It's a bias that creeps in. So when you see figures like this where we found, you know, that people were saying 40% had been abducted, it's an awfully, awfully high number. 31% had a child that was abducted, 58% witnessed a child, and so on. Even if we move these figures back, taking in social desirability, this is a very highly traumatized population. Our surveys in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, and particularly Rwanda, showed similar levels. But this is, for 18 years, this has been a very traumatized population. So there are immediate needs and concerns, and this shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. What's most important here is people want peace and people want food. Justice, at this point in the interview, this is one of the first questions we asked, was not significant. What was significant was peace and food. And if you go to the camps, you understand why. Some of the camps do get regular food from the World Food Program, but they're not often, food doesn't arrive. Malnutrition is high in the camps. People are desperate, as Marika was saying earlier. Peace and justice. However, when you start talking to people about justice, we found that the majority of respondents, 76%, said those responsible for abuses should be held accountable for their actions. Now, this is both government and LRA. When the interviewers probed further to identify those who should be held accountable, 37% respondents said LRA leaders should be held accountable for their crimes, whereas more than half, 58%, did not want the lower-ranking members to be held accountable. This goes back to the issue that Marika was raising, is that these are people who realize that these are their own children or their neighbors' children who've been recruited. In terms of accountability,
We found that forgiveness was 25%, said that there should be forgiveness. What would you like to see happen to those LRA leaders who are responsible for violations? 22% said forgive, 2% confront and confess to community, 1% compensate victims, and this is significant. 66% said they wanted punishment, which was trial, imprisonment, or actually to kill. These are the LRA leaders, not the lower ranks. Amnesty. Now, the Amnesty Commission, which Marika mentioned had been established, has been operating for several years now. We found that this was actually significant, that 65% of the population we interviewed had heard of the Amnesty Commission. They felt that those people should receive amnesty, but 29% said they would not accept amnesty if it was the only road to peace. It's fair to say that there, in the North, the acceptance of the Amnesty Commission is clearly there, and they see a need for it among those people we interviewed. What would you require those who are amnesty to do before you accept them back into the community? Without going into too far here, confession for wrongdoing, apologize, very high, and this is significant. I'm really only going to point out the things that are subject them to trial and other lower percentages here. Now, we did not read a list to people. They were allowed to choose what they wanted to say, so they could choose many things. So again, just keep in mind this apologize at 56%. We'll come back to that. So in the question, and we ask these questions for many dimensions because you're trying to tease out what are very difficult issues, and people, all of us will say contradictory things, and you want to find out what's the essence of what we're trying to get at here. Well, so on the question of peace and justice, in Acholi districts, peace with trials and punishment, 44%, peace with amnesty, 56%. In the non-Acholi, 39%, with amnesty, 61%, with trials and punishment. Now, this is interesting because it's very close. But there's clearly a need there for both peace and justice. Knowledge about traditional justice systems or traditional ceremonies. Overall, 36% know about the traditional justice system or traditional ceremonies, but higher in Acholi districts. Respondents from two Acholi districts, 5 minutes, okay. Respondents from two Acholi districts were more than five times higher or more likely than those from non-Acholi districts. Of those who had knowledge of these systems and ceremonies, a little more than half of 56% had participated in such ceremonies, and 48% that these said these ceremonies would be useful dealing with the LRA. What's significant for us here is, I want to really just skip the first one because a matter of time, the majority of respondents, 73%, said they knew nothing or very little about the ICC's existence and of its work. And of those who had heard of the court, the majority attached high expectations to it, believing that the ICC would both bring peace and justice. And those are very high percentages. I'm actually going to skip this and go to our conclusions. One, the levels of exposure and violence in northern Uganda are extremely high. Immediate needs of peace and food and peace and justice are not mutually exclusive. Accountability for crimes committed by all sides is a priority. That's both government and LRA. And that the amnesty process should be reformed. And this goes back to that apology. What was coming out of this is that people were seeing the LRA children, the younger ones, coming out fine. But those who are at a middling command level, who are coming out and being given reintegration packages and walking out and apologizing, our sample did not like that. And it raises the issue of whether a truth commission is something that needs to be implemented in some form. And that traditional justice and formal justice mechanisms are poorly understood. So our recommendations are that let's cut through this justice-peace debate, let's sit at a table, let's talk about what can be done at various levels to deal with this issue. That the amnesty process should be reformed, and I spoke to the head of the Amnesty Commission, and he is open to that. That's more inclusive about the needs of victims. Increased consultation on the part of local leaders about traditional justice systems because people are not that aware of them. And the International Criminal Court, that it really needs to start a program where it informs the public about its activities. So I'm going to just finish with a few more points, which step away a bit from from the study and my own observations and Marika's that we've come brought from other countries and which we've worked in. The key statement I want to say was Judith Sklar, and I think this quote should be in this part of this conference, or maybe should be the opening of the next conference, and that is to say, to show that justice has its practical and ideological limits is not to slight it. The entire aim is to account for the difficulties which the morality of justice faces in a morally pluralistic world and help it recognize its real place in it, not above the political world, but in its very midst. It has everything to do with politics and daily life, and that was said earlier in this panel. The other is, half of knowledge, as Sam Johnson once said, is knowing where to find it. The when the ICC and other tribunals move into these countries, we need to build up knowledge about the cultural, political, social dynamics. Population-based surveys, there are a lot of us out there in the university who would be more than happy to come in and try and say, you know, here are the issues you really need to be looking at. So I'm hanging my shingle here. The other is to say the public face of the international criminal justice needs to be not the hunter and the hunted. It is not just the office of the prosecutor. It is the three branches that need to be known and seen. That's not just the prosecutor's office out there looking for suspected war criminals. The tension between low and high profile, you need to have witness protection, but at the same time, a more vigorous effort by the tribunal and funding into those countries to educate people about its objectivities. I'll just finish on one point, and that is the impunity gap. And that is the challenge that goes beyond the ICC. It goes to non-governmental organizations, it goes to donors and governments, and that challenge is that you need to help, don't just look at the small box of the ICC, and it is small, although they're going after big fish. You need other transitional justice mechanisms. We need to be in northern Uganda helping with the international criminal justice system there, truth commissions and other activities. And this is just as important. And as Hannah Arendt once said, and I'll finish there, I've changed the quote somewhat, but it was referred to a case, but a tribunal should never promise more than it can deliver. We have to be humble in this effort, and we need to bring in as many people who can help us collaborate as possible. Thanks.
Thank you for those two very interesting presentations. Before I go any further, I just need to explain a little bit about where I'm from. I'm from an organisation called Oxfam, which is a humanitarian and development organisation, one of the NGOs that Eric referred to. We work in about 80 countries around the world, and today I want to add maybe some thoughts based on our experience of working in Uganda, where I am the director of programming. There can be no lasting peace without justice. I think we're all clear about that. And that's why Oxfam and other humanitarian organisations like Oxfam, organisations that we work with as part of advocacy coalitions on peace in northern Uganda, have long supported the ICC, the formation of international criminal justice mechanisms to fight impunity. The ICC has been seen as a new weapon in the fight to bring justice and to resolve conflicts. And we support the court in those actions. But Eric and Marika in particular referred to some of the problems or issues that have come up and perception perhaps that there has been a polarisation of the debate, justice or peace. And I think the reality is that although we all support both peace and justice and believe that these two things cannot be separated, the reality is that the objectives of peace and justice can be very difficult to marry. From Sri Lanka to South Africa, people have been faced with really difficult choices about how to pursue these aims together. There's no one answer, there's no single template. So I just want to share with you some of the experiences that we have had as a humanitarian organisation and our colleagues in civil society organisations have had in grappling with these difficult issues in Uganda. I don't want to repeat the background story of Uganda. You've already heard and seen. Thanks for the pictures. That's great. A good description of what's happening in Uganda. But maybe just to talk a little bit about the peace process. Uganda suffered from conflict, as Marika mentioned, since independence. And I think, as a British national, I should acknowledge since before independence as well. And that colonial legacy lives on. And there's very serious conflicts that are deep-rooted and multifaceted in Uganda and throughout the region. Attempts to broker peace in Uganda have a checkered history. And there are many views as to why these peace processes have failed before. But there seems to be one clear lesson, if one can be drawn, and that is effective peacemaking must involve genuine partnerships between government, military, the rebels, the entire cross-section of the community, with international support and commitment from all the parties. There is a current tentative process which has attempted to make this learning a reality. However, after a year of painful and careful contacts, which Mr. Ocampos mentioned earlier at lunch, including the first face-to-face contact between the Lord's Resistance Army and the government for a decade last year, it seems that peace is still elusive, and indeed hopes are fading that this process can really deliver something concrete anytime soon. Civil society organisations in Uganda recognise that the primary role of the International Criminal Court is to tackle impunity for the worst crimes that human beings commit against each other. And the involvement of the International Criminal Court has been seen by many as a tool to provide maybe a new way of resolving this conflict. And some have, for example, argued that the presence of the ICC may actually provide a new incentive for rebels to talk peace and the carrot and stick that we've heard so much about today. However, many civil society organisations and colleagues of mine in Uganda have real concerns about the impact of the legal process on any potential peace process. And this view is about the fear that victims' interests won't be served by any action that threatens a peaceful solution to the conflict, and the fear that the timing of the ICC indictments could have a negative impact. And again, Mr. Kampu, you stole a lot of my thunder with your very eloquent description of those dilemmas. I want to talk about what some of the potential impacts of criminal action might be on the peace process. And again, I want to be clear that I'm not trying to take a position for and against peace or justice, but trying to represent some real dilemmas that we're facing on the ground. There are fears, as has been mentioned, that the international criminal justice process could jeopardise the peace process. And the primary fear is that criminal action might be putting at risk the very people that we seek to protect. So again, as you mentioned over lunch, the concern that perhaps that rebels may resort to more violence against civilians. And we should note that in the history of this 20-year conflict, there really is no reason to have confidence that, for example, government forces have any capacity to protect civilians in northern Uganda. Experience shows us that the Lord's Resistance Army monitors developments and takes reprisals accordingly. So there is perhaps some reason to suggest that increased violence may result. Also, the manager of a humanitarian organisation, I'm keenly aware that it is possible that the LRA may start to target attacks against humanitarian agencies and against international agencies perceived as being supporters of the court. And that might seriously affect our capacity to deliver life-saving aid to people who are in desperate need. And again, these may not be reasons not to pursue prosecution, but they are certainly factors that we need to consider, both in the timing of the actions, but also in the way that we plan other actions around any criminal prosecution. There are also concerns about the peace talks. The mediator, Betty Bigombe, has expressed concern that, for example, the international donor support that she has for her peace talks may have to be withdrawn if arrest warrants are issued. And there are lots of lack of clarity about what will happen. And the LRA itself has repeatedly said that arrest warrants are an obstacle to peace. Why would they come and negotiate to come in if they're going to be arrested? It makes sense. Whether you take the LRA seriously is another matter. And there is also a perception, as Marika and Eric mentioned, that the issue of arrest warrants may actually undermine the Amnesty Act, which is widely supported in northern Uganda and indeed more broadly. And it has been seen as a crucial tool for peace, if not for justice, and at least offers some degree of fairness, insofar as that is possible in this situation, for the many returnees who left involuntarily and fought involuntarily. I was very struck by a conversation I had recently with a returned commander, middle-ranking commander from the LRA. He's 30 years old. He was abducted when he was 16 years old, and he escaped after 13 and a half years with the LRA. And he said to me, "Make no mistake, every day I was waiting to get out. It took me 13 and a half years to feel like the right moment had arrived where I could walk away." So, you know, for people who've experienced that kind of that kind of trauma, you know, we have to find a way of dealing with them in a way that both reflects the fact that they are perpetrators, but they're also victims. Finally, the question that pops up time and time again in terms of the understanding the impact on the peace process in northern Uganda is whether or not it's actually possible to arrest these guys if warrants are issued at all. And given that the risks that people have identified, whether we rate them high probability or low probability, they are serious risks. And again, as Mr. Ocampo mentioned earlier, it's very much an awful decision to have to say, you know, the decision that I'm about to make could cost the lives of people. That's a very weighty decision to have to make, however small the probability of that risk coming to pass. But what a lot of people have asked us when we're on the ground is, well, if arrest warrants are issued, does that mean that, you know, the war will be over? And we have to say, well, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's not currently clear that, of course, the Ugandan army has any capacity to arrest the leaders of the LRA. If they had, one would assume that they would have perhaps done it in sometime in the past 19 years. And, you know, with other political complications, it's certainly not clear that there would be another possibility, for example, in northern Uganda, of an external force that would be able to do that. So the question is obvious. If it's not possible to arrest, or if the chances of arrest are so unlikely, then should we be taking the risks of endangering the peace process and possibly endangering the lives of civilians too? To be very clear, again, to express concern about the nature of the international criminal process is not to promote impunity. And colleagues have already mentioned, you know, there are alternative ways and other ways, complementary ways, that we might want to deal with this problem. We've long advocated for an end to impunity, and victims of conflict, as we've heard, are clear that there can be no peace without justice. The question is, as Eric posed, what does justice mean in this situation, and how can we marry these two challenges together? Some ideas for local solutions. Reconciliation. A big word and difficult to translate into a Acholi, as we've already heard. An absence of violence in northern Uganda, indeed the arrest of the top five or six commanders, which would be a dream come true for all of us, is not the same as a just and lasting peace. And this conflict has its roots at least partly in cycles of revenge and mistrust that have affected Uganda for decades. A national truth and reconciliation process, as mentioned by Eric, is necessary to address these deep-rooted issues. But this process needs consistent leadership, especially in a culture of strong leaders like Uganda. The government of Uganda has yet to take up this challenge seriously, and despite having requested the ICC's intervention and provided space for various peace initiatives, there's no evidence that they are serious about addressing the deep-rooted issues. And this has led many commentators and peace actors to suggest that the government is not serious about peace in the longer term. Traditional mechanisms. Traditional leaders are working in northern Uganda on trying to understand how traditional mechanisms could be adapted and made to work. We recognise there are a range of problems, which Eric mentioned. But we do think the role and value of traditional mechanisms needs to be recognised, particularly in the context where we're not very clear about what people understand justice to mean, or at least we are clear, but it's not the same as perhaps our Western understanding of justice. The role and the value of traditional mechanisms is well recognised by the ICC and others. And we need to nurture and develop these mechanisms, as Eric said. We think actually that the amnesty law and the role of the Amnesty Commission could become much stronger and actually take on these roles as Eric has hinted. For example, by requiring returnees to actually go through processes of acknowledging guilt, apologising, and possibly paying reparations, performing some kind of national service or a similar kind of approach. And civil society organisations are working, seeking to work within the Amnesty Commission to do that. Truth-telling, compensation, community service, all of these things could be supported by a well-resourced Amnesty Commission. So in conclusion, an international criminal process can only be implemented in the context of a deep understanding of what justice means more broadly for people on the ground. And this understanding necessarily includes an assessment of the potential negative impacts of the peace process, the interests of the victims. This is really context specific, and a judgment about whether or not an international criminal process is appropriate in that place at that particular time doesn't undermine the idea that in other environments at other stages or in the same environment at another stage, it will be appropriate, but just that in this particular context, at this particular time, it may not be. And in the case of Uganda, there are well-founded concerns that a legal process will undermine relief operations and peace efforts in the short term. It doesn't mean that international legal action won't be appropriate in the medium term, it may even happen sooner than that. But the timing must respect the ongoing peace efforts. And in any case, practical measures need to be taken to ensure its effectiveness. And we already know that an international criminal process is insufficient if we are to deliver just and lasting peace. And in agreement with Eric, I would say that it's not fair to expect the ICC to deliver all of this. I think in Uganda, ICC bashing at one stage almost became as popular as UN bashing seems to be in the US. It's too easy. It's far too easy. It's the responsibility of all of us, international donors, NGOs, national governments, to deliver on these complementary efforts, to deliver on the nurturing of the traditional justice systems and the truth and reconciliation processes. And we can't seek those who are responsible for delivering the international criminal process to be responsible for that wider process. So we all have to play our part. But in the absence of sufficient support for the other justice mechanisms, and there is a huge glaring gap in that area in Uganda, it's possible that an international criminal process will be less effective than it should. Indeed, it's possible that the process may be unable to deliver prosecution and may even be compromising the effectiveness of other justice and peace initiatives. So there must be an end to impunity. There can be no peace without justice. The challenge that faces us is to make the international process complement traditional justice processes, work together with local initiatives, and so really contribute to a just and lasting peace. Thanks.
Thanks very much to all the panelists for not only informative and interesting remarks, but for, even though we started 15 minutes late, allowing us maybe 10 minutes for questions and answers. Remarks? Doug?
Terrific panel. Thank you very much. I thought Robert Pulver's principles were compelling and attractive. I think implicit in them is one more that I would add, and this is also a partial response to the provocative questions we received from the chief prosecutor at lunch today, and that is flexibility. It seems to me, although this is a very much parochial common law formulation of it, that a prosecutor in any of these tribunals needs to rely, and I'd be happy to have it translated into civil law terms, on prosecutorial discretion exercised in the interests of justice. And that means a great deal of flexibility. It means avoiding rigid criteria that automatically trigger or preclude an investigation or prosecution. A number of the factors of flexibility have been mentioned here today. Timing. Secondly, who to prosecute in a situation like Uganda, where we're hearing, and I don't know anything about Uganda, but we're hearing that 90% of the combatants and the perpetrators were involuntarily recruited young people. That's a very different situation from a situation where the perpetrators are voluntarily participating adults. Flexibility also with regard to a recognition that this is not a one-size-fits-all solution. For example, listening to the tension between peace and justice in Uganda today, I'm reminded of when I was in Colombia 2 weeks ago, where the very same debate was being held, but against a very different background, very different context, and I would suggest with very different answers than the ones one would come up with in Uganda. And finally, a recognition, and a number of speakers have said this, and I endorse it, that an international prosecutor cannot afford to avoid realpolitik. I apologize to both David Crane and Siri Freegard for saying this in their absence. At least I don't see them here in the room. But had I been advising either of them, I would not have advised David to go around and tell people in Sierra Leone that no one is above the law and that the law is fair. That's something that cannot be controlled by an international prosecutor, and if it turns out not to be true, it can have very corrosive effects for a culture of the rule of law. And similarly, to issue indictments in East Timor against General Wiranto in Indonesia, and in the process to have any illusion that indictment would actually lead to a prosecution in the short term, short of a miraculous intervention, it seems to me is an indication of a lawyer who needs to have political advisors. So I think this panel, which has shown very strong sensitivity to all the points that I just mentioned, is really an excellent panel, and it's very fortunate that the Chief Prosecutor was here to listen to it, although I suspect he knows all this stuff already.
I'm Sarah Cobb. I'm the director of the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University, and I have a question for Eric and Marika. Could you elaborate a little bit how the linguists actually helped you folks define the notion of justice? Because it's not, you know, we have Western notions, but I would be very curious about the complexity of the concept for the folks in Uganda.
I actually can't tell you because I wasn't there. we had two, and actually it was better that Marika and I weren't there. We had two epidemiologists who were associated with the Human Rights Center, but they're from Tulane, and neither of them have been that involved in human rights and international humanitarian law themselves. They really work on humanitarian issues, but it was good that they did it because I've worked in criminal justice for a number of years, and Marika's has, and you could bring your own biases. So they actually supervised the survey, and that was important that there was that independence. I don't know. I can't really answer the question, but I could let you know because they actually sat down with this group and okay.
No, the only other thing I was going to say is that we did also as part of the survey, although we had to, of course, reduce. I would encourage everyone who's interested to read it because we also did ask people, how do you understand these basic concepts, justice, peace, reconciliation, and also human rights? And there was a higher level of coincidence between how people understood peace and reconciliation as opposed to how they understood justice and human rights.
I was planning to be...
Sorry, I was going to just say just as an example, when we've talked to communities about justice issues in northern Uganda, the idea that somebody could be taken to a court and plead not guilty, but be convicted and sentenced for a punishment in most of the cultural context in northern Uganda is extraordinary. People can't understand how somebody could be considered to have been punished if they've never admitted what they did. So that gives an idea of the enormous sort of gaps and confusions in understanding.
I was planning to be very discreet, but I'd like to thank for organizing this meeting. I think this panel showed the complexity of my work. Because Douglas, you offered me be flexible. But people discuss, no, you cannot be flexible. You should be a prosecutor. So I think this case showed the complexity. Uganda case is probably very complicated, probably the simple case I have. Sudan is more complicated, and Congo is more complicated. So, and this is my job. I will do two things. First, explain how I perform my job. I understand the complexity. So I explained today in the lunch about how we are trying to not interfere with the peace process, respect the peace process, working very low-key, at the same time doing my job, doing my work, investigating. I understand the risk. In fact, I'm managing risk because I can produce more killings if I'm not going ahead or if I'm stopping, I guess. If I'm going ahead, I can produce crimes. If I'm not going ahead, I could produce crimes. So it's not a solution which I can say, oh, this is the solution. So all I can say is manage risk. And what I did is try to do the best. So I did more than 30 trips to northern Uganda to meet with people. I like very much the report that Eric and Mike did because they provide us in very useful information. I met personally with the leaders of the Acholi region in my court for 3 days. Then I asked them how to combine, because at the beginning, the killings were against the Acholis, but in the last 2 years, just 40% of the crimes are against the Acholis. So Teso and Lango are affected, and this creates tension between them. So I asked the Acholis, look, the information we have is some of you are against the prosecution, but in Lango and Teso, they like the prosecution, so how to combine this? So they told me, look, maybe you can organize a meeting with all of us together. So we did it. We had a meeting with all the community represented, and even the government, because it's so divided that the government was not happy when we invited local communities. So I put together all of them in the court. So I was listening, all of them, and in fact, I have much more information than you have because I'm combining totally different sources, but I cannot expose my information. So the only thing I can tell you is, look, I am very aware of the problems. I am managing risk. On terms of protections, we did a long session with the government to be sure they are increasing the protection for the people. We are personally in the court taking measures to protect the witnesses. We did a lot of efforts to convince the neighbor countries who are involved in these crimes to do something different and to try to arrest them, and we are doing enormous efforts to mobilize international community. So the result, we are managing risk, but we are doing the most we can do. But the next step is, Emma is right. A prosecutor cannot solve this problem. My only duty is to investigate and prosecute. I did it. I have a wonderful case in terms of evidence. I have a perfect case against the leader of LRA. I will not prosecute the other. So it's interesting because from the beginning I was explaining I'm not prosecuting more than the leaders, but there's still information coming. What about the amnesty? The leaders are not, they did not receive the amnesty. You have to be out of the bush to receive the amnesty. So I have not any problem with the amnesty. And in fact, I need other actors making agreements with the others who are not the leaders. I need efforts from humanitarian NGOs. I need effort for peace, because dialogue for peace, we need to do it with other leaders. We need to improve the security. We have to solve the IDP camp, the food, all these problems, and I cannot solve it. So that is the problem I have being a state-led prosecutor. Even I do my job in the best way, maybe my contribution is not so high. And that's why, as legal scholars, you need to present all these dimensions of the problems. And we have to find a way in which we really create a coalition to provide the service that a normal state is providing in a country, in these areas in which there is no state. And we have to invent a new method to work together, and I hope this first case will teach us how to improve our capacity. But today, I think we are doing the best we can, and we are taking all the measures you suggest, we are taking them. In fact, even outreach project, one of the problems we have, we don't like to make discussion in public with some leaders who are promoting peace. On the contrary, we choose a low profile, and then they were allowed to make the efforts to make negotiations. So we were very flexible. We tried to do the best. I hope we can do a good work, but we will, even in the best scenario that we arrest these 5 guys and stop the crimes, then still problem of peace, problem of security, problem of food. That's why I need actors playing with us. Thank you.
Kelly. I just wanted to go back to one point just to be clear about justice when we were talking. When it came to the LRA leaders, unequivocally, people understood what they meant by justice. They meant trial, some of them wanted death, and some of them wanted to eat them. So I'm telling you, you have to understand the LRA leaders are special to the other rank and file. So we're not talking about people thinking it's some kind of form of reconciliation. When it came to the leaders, they definitely want them tried. Okay.
There's so much to talk about, but maybe just to pick up on a couple of points. I think it's the earlier point about realpolitik and the awareness that none of us operate in a vacuum, and we're all part of a big patchwork. I mean, this is the jigsaw puzzle that someone was talking about this morning. While absolutely, there's no way that we can hold the International Criminal Court responsible for all of these things. If you were able to deliver them, then that would be very marvelous. But beyond the capacity of any mortal, and I think, but we also need to be aware that we don't operate in a vacuum. And I guess you know, and so we have to understand that the broadest consequences of our actions potentially. I mean, for me, I really think it's a challenge to the international community very broadly, that many states got together and went through a very difficult process of establishing the International Criminal Court, and that was, a really very happy day for I'm sure everybody who was here. I think those states have to show the same level of commitment to actually making the court work, and that means that that when the court comes to its first very difficult case, as you said, it might be the simplest case you have, but it's, as you also say, it's extremely difficult. That it's not enough to say, we made you, now go and do it. There's actually, a whole complex realpolitik to be dealt with, and the states that supported the formation of the International Criminal Court also have to be able to deliver on commitments like actually being able to arrest, to detain and arrest the perpetrators of these crimes, and I think there is a sense at the moment that this is, that of course Mr. Ocampo is doing his best, but there's an absence of anything else. That is a really very grave concern. I think you mentioned earlier, I can't remember the exact figure you used, but how much the ad hoc tribunals cost the UN?
$250 million.
A quarter of $1 billion a year? I wish that kind of money was being spent on actually enabling the rest of this patchwork to work. Again, not diminishing the role of those tribunals, but we can't invest so much in one area and then abdicate responsibility for the delivery of the rest. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I would just briefly add the issue of a prosecutor needing to be sort of informed by all of these other factors, the political factors, the sociological factors, statistical and social surveys, et cetera. I think it's a two-way street. And I'm not so sure that our political decision makers, our diplomats, our peace negotiators are aware of human rights and justice issues and are as informed by this audience and by the sociological data as they should be.
We're open for invitation.
Just briefly, Nina Bong Jensen, I just wanted to speak up, not in the context so much of the ICC, because I think the challenges facing the prosecutor there are enormous, and this panel has well illustrated this. But I don't think we should be too quick to say that we shouldn't be indicting people who are not easily apprehended, as one of the questions was raised earlier. Because in fact, if you think back on the court for former Yugoslavia, if you think back on East Timor, those indictments of people who were not easily within the reach of the courts led to peace. Karadzic was delegitimized. He was unable to continue the negotiations. They were forced to put in someone else. Milosevic was delegitimized by the negotiations and eventually left office. So it's something I think we should remember as well, that in all these cases there is always the argument about pushing peace forward and we can't do it now, we can't indict now because peace as an issue. Just a little comment about the past.
I just to comment. I agree with that, but I think the main thrust of my argument is that contexts are very complex, and every context is different. And I mean, this is an argument that's been put forward in Uganda, and we could talk for hours about the special things about the context which make it different from every other context. But I think, you know, we just need to be aware that you know, there are, you know, people who have political constituencies who need support to continue their stay in their situation of authority, and you have people like, you know, the Lord's Resistance Army who have never had a constituency, you know, and there are all sorts of other factors at play. So, I mean, you may be right, but I think my caution is to say that these judgments have to be very context specific, and they might change over time as well.
Give it a very, very brief, and this is the last comment.
Just a couple observations based on my research in the North in August when I was there. First, one detail that was in your report that was also highlighted while I was there was the lack of knowledge people have as to whether or not the ICC has capacity to arrest. Many people were under the impression that the ICC does have its own army, and that if the ICC is here, that means that they're going to get them. And when you inform people that the ICC does not have an army, then people ask, well, then why are they here? And if they issue indictments, what's the point? And that, I mean, that is something to take into consideration in issuing indictments or proceeding along this path that could actually undermine ICC legitimacy if it is not able to enforce that which it seeks to execute. One other thing is that when I was talking to people very closely involved with the peace process was this issue comes up as to how do we assess whether a peace process is going well or not. You can look at the history of the Ugandan peace processes and see it both ways, but I think something that needs to be emphasized is that each peace process is different, and the current mediator, Betty Bigombe, said that she is dealing with a leader who is unpredictable, has a very different psychology, for which she needs a lot more time and patience on the part of everybody, NGOs, governments, ICC, etc., in order to actually get to a point where she can have substantive discussions. So that's the other thing I would add.
One very small point. I mean, about the knowledge of the ICC and whether people support it more if they know more. I think our research simply shows that perhaps expectations are, in fact, I mean, almost dangerously high, and there'll be a challenge to manage them. But at the same time, this is expectations of the ICC process in particular. But at the same time, I think that does nothing to retract from the fact that people do want to see criminal justice. And the reality is that this is probably going to come through the medium of the ICC sooner than from any other process that is out there. But there is certainly a challenge there for the ICC in terms of outreach and managing expectations.
Starting right now, the Washington College of Law invites everybody to a reception in the sixth floor dining hall, and just help me thank the panelists once again for their presentation.